This is Audible.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Penguin Random House Audio presents Star Wars Alphabet Squadron by Alexander Freed. Read for you by Saskia Marleveld. Part 1. Elements of a Killing Machine. Chapter 1. Situational Awareness. 1. I was 18 kilometers above sea level when they caught me, she said. The droid measured her heart rate from across the room, 62 beats per minute, 7 above her baseline, and stored her voice print for post-session analysis. It performed a cursory optical scan and noted the scrapes on her lips and forehead, the sling supporting her right arm. She had begun to regain muscle mass, though she remained, the droid permitted itself a poetic flourish, frail.
You remember the precise altitude? The droid asked.
For this interaction, it had chosen a masculine voice, bass and hollow. The sound projected from a speaker on the underside of its spherical black chassis. I have an extremely good memory. The droid oriented the red lens of its photoreceptor, as if to stare.
So do I.
The woman met its gaze. The droid readjusted the lens. This is the story she told. 18 kilometers above the surface of the planet Necronus, Erica Quell fled for her life. The silt storm raged outside her starfighter, blue and yellow mud roiling against the faceted viewport. A burst of wind lifted the ship's portside wing, nearly sending her into a spin. She adjusted her repulsors with her gloved left hand, while the right urged a rattling lever into position. The ship leveled out, and the comforting howl of its twin ion engines rose to a screech as 6 million stony granules entered the exhaust. Quell winced as she bounced in her harness, listening to her vessel's agony. Emerald light shot past the viewport, incinerating ribbons of airborne mud. She increased her thrust and plunged deeper into the storm, ignoring the engine scream. Her scanner showed 3 marks rapidly closing from behind, 2 fewer than she'd hoped for. She moved a hand to the comm, recalibrated her frequency, and called out 2 names.
Tonus? Barath?
When no one answered, she recalibrated again and tried.
This is TIE pilot Erica Quell to Necronus Ground Control.
But Tonus and Barath were surely dead, and the locals were jammed, out of range, or ardently inclined to ignore her. Another volley of emerald particle bolts sizzled past her ship. Quell maintained her vector. She was a fine defensive pilot, but only the storm could keep her alive now. She had to trust the wind and the blinding mud to throw off her enemy's aim. Her comm sounded at last.
Lieutenant Quell!
She leaned forward, straining at her harness, trying to peer through the storm as her teeth chattered and her hips knocked against her seat. A ribbon of blue silt streaked by, and she glimpsed, beyond it, a flash of white light, lightning ahead and 20 degrees to port.
Lieutenant Quell, please acknowledge.
She considered her options. She could head toward the lightning, toward the storm's center where the winds would be strongest. There she could try to locate an updraft, reduce her thrust, overcharge her repulsors, and let the draft and the repulsors' anti-gravity toss her ship high while her pursuers passed below. If she didn't black out, if she didn't become disoriented, she could dip back down and re-engage her enemy from behind, eliminating 1, maybe 2, before they realized where she'd gone.
You are hereby ordered to reduce speed, eject, and await pickup, detention, and court-martial.
She couldn't imagine that the man on the other end of the comm would fall for such a maneuver. More likely, she'd be shot down while she spun helplessly through the sky. Of course, she'd also be shot if she ejected. Major Soren Keyes was a good man, an admirable man, but she knew there would be no court-martial. She changed course toward the lightning and pitched her ship incrementally downward. Toward the ground, she reminded herself. Ground, like atmosphere and gravity, was a challenge she normally flew without. Another flash of emerald suggested her foes were getting closer, likely attempting to catch her in their crossfire. She let the wind guide her. She couldn't outfly Major Keyes, but she was at least as good as his squadron mates. She'd flown with Shauna, seen Tong's flight stats, and Quell deserved her fate if she couldn't match them both. She dived through a ribbon of yellow silt that left her momentarily blind, then reduced her repulsor output until the TIE fighter's aerodynamics took over and sent it veering at a sharp angle. Quell might find atmospheric flight challenging, but her opponents would find an enemy jerked about by gravity positively confounding. The next volley of particle blasts was just a glimmer in her peripheral vision. They would be back on her soon. A thunderclap loud enough to resonate in her bones reassured her she was near the storm's center. She wondered, startled by the thought, if she should say something to the Major before the end, make some last plea or acknowledgement of their years together, then blotted the idea from her mind. She'd made her decision. She looked through her streaked cockpit at the swirling vortex of colors. She accelerated as hard as the TIE would allow, checked her instruments through the pain in her skull and the glimmering spots in front of her eyes, counted to five, then tilted her fighter an additional 50 degrees toward the ground. After that, two events occurred nearly simultaneously. Somehow, she was aware of them both. As Quell's fighter rushed toward the surface of Macronus, her three pursuers, already accelerating to match Quell's speed, flew directly toward the storm center. Two of the enemy TIEs, according to her scanner, attempted to break away. They were caught by the gale, and as they decelerated, swept into each other. Both were immediately destroyed in the collision. The third pilot attempted to navigate the gauntlet of lightning and silt. He fared better, but his starfighter wasn't equal to his skill. Something went wrong. Quell guessed that silt particles had crept into seams in the TIE's armor, or that a lightning strike had shorted the fighter's systems. And Major Soren Keyes, too, disappeared from her scanner. The ace of the 204th Imperial Fighter Wing was dead. At the same time her pursuers met their end, Quell attempted to break out of her dive. She saw nothing of the world outside her cockpit, nothing beyond her instruments, and her body felt leaden as she operated the TIE's controls. She'd managed to level out the ship when she heard a deafening crash and felt her seat heave beneath her. She realized half a second later that the bottom of her starboard wing had struck the mire of the Cronus's surface and was dragging through the silt. Half a second after that, she lost total control of her vessel and made the mistake of reaching for the ejector switch with her right hand. The TIE fighter halted abruptly, and she was thrown at the now cracked viewport. The safety harness caught her extended right arm and snapped her brittle bones as the straps cut into her body. Her face smashed against the inside of her flight helmet. Agony and nausea followed. She heard nothing but an unidentifiable dull roar. She blacked out and woke almost immediately, swiftly enough to savor the still fresh pain. Quell had an extremely good memory, but she didn't remember cutting herself free of the safety harness or clambering out of the cockpit hatch. She didn't remember whether she'd vomited when she'd removed her helmet. She remembered, vaguely, the smell of burning circuits and her own sweat. But that was all, until she sat on top of her broken craft amid a multicolored marsh and looked up at the sky. She couldn't tell if it was night or day. The swirling, iridescent storm looked like an oily whirlpool, blotting out sun or stars, or both. It churned and grew, visibly expanding moment by moment. Glimmering above the white lightning, faint and high, were the orange lights of atmospheric explosions, the payloads of other TIE fighters. The explosions would stoke the storm, Quell knew, stoke and feed it and others like it, until storms tore through every city on the Cronus. The silt would flay towers and citadels to their steel bones. Children would choke on mud flooding the streets. All because an order had been given, and only Quell and Tonus and Barath had bothered to defy it. This was what her empire had become in the days after Endor. She saw it now, but she was too late to save Necronus.
"You were fortunate to survive,"
the droid said when Erica Quell finished her story. "The tie gave me somewhere to shelter. The open marshland wasn't hit as hard as the main settlements."
"I don't doubt it. My observation stands. Do you feel fortunate, Lieutenant Quell?"
She wrinkled her nose. Her eyes flickered from the spherical droid to the corrugated metal walls of the repurposed shipping container where they met. "Why shouldn't I?" she asked. "I'm alive, and I've been assigned a charming therapist." The droid hesitated, ran the statement through multiple analysis programs, and was pleasantly surprised to conclude that its patient's hostility was omnidirectional, counterproductive, and obnoxious, but in no way aimed at the droid. Creating a rapport remained possible. It was, in fact, a priority, albeit not the droid's only priority.
"Let's resume tomorrow,"
the droid said,
"and talk more about what happened between your crash and your discovery by the emergency crew."
Quell grunted and rose, raising the hood of her poncho before taking the single step needed to reach the shipping container's door. She paused there and looked from the droid's photoreceptor to the injector syringe attached to its manipulator. "Do people try to hurt you?" she asked. "When they see an Imperial torture droid waiting to treat them?" This time her voice suggested an admixture of hostility and curiosity.
"I see very few patients,"
the droid answered. That fact was dangerously close to qualifying as classified intelligence, but the droid deemed the risk of breach acceptably low next to the benefits of earning Quell's trust. Quell only grunted again and departed. The droid reviewed the recorded conversation 17 times. It focused on the woman's biofeedback throughout, but it didn't neglect more conventional verbal analysis. Quell's story, it decided, was largely consistent with the testimony of a traumatized Imperial defector. Nonetheless, the droid was certain she was lying. 2. Traitor's Remorse was a frost-bitten shanty town of an outpost. Once a nameless rebel base built to harbor a handful of desperate insurgents, it had evolved into a sprawling maze of improvised shelters, security fencing, and duracrete bunkers, housing 12,000 would-be defectors from the crumbling Galactic Empire. Under an ashen sky, former Imperial military personnel suffered debriefings and scrutiny and medical examinations as they waited for the nascent rebel government, the so-called New Republic, to determine their fate. Most of the defectors occupied the outpost only in passing. They were infantry and engineers, comscan officers and admiral's aides. Designated low risk or high value, they received an offer of leniency and redeployment within a week, then shipped out to crew captured Star Destroyers, or to join orbital minesweeper teams. Meanwhile, those less fortunate, the defectors designated high risk and low value by whatever New Republic interviewer they'd annoyed, were stuck trying to prove themselves reliable, loyal, and of sound moral character, without going mad from tedium. Erica Quell occupied the latter category. She didn't think the name Traitor's Remorse was funny, but after a month she couldn't think of one better. On a foggy afternoon, Quell jogged down the gravel path running from her housing unit to the landing pads. She kept her pace slow to reduce the throbbing in her shoulder and minimize the bounce of her sling, rapidly transitioning from chilled to overheated to clammy with cold sweat. She shouldn't have been running at all in her condition. She hadn't needed to heal naturally from a broken bone since she'd been 12 years old. But medical Bacta was in short supply for ex-Imperials. She ran anyway. Her routine was the only thing keeping her sane. Once she would have cleared her mind by flying. That wasn't an option now. Certainly her therapist wasn't doing much good. The reprogrammed ITO torture droid seemed more interested in examining and re-examining her last flight than in helping her adapt to her circumstances. There was nothing useful about the images of Necronus the droid had dredged up in her mind. Silt storms tearing through settlements, explosions in the sky. Nothing that would serve her or the New Republic. Yet until the droid was satisfied, it seemed she wouldn't be allowed to move on. She approached a checkpoint and turned off the gravel path 10 meters before the entrance to the landing zone, running alongside the fence surrounding the tarmac. Brittle cyan grass crunched satisfyingly under her boots. One of the sentries threw her a wave, and she returned a curt nod. This, too, was part of her routine. She kept running, past the informal junk swap and the communications tower. 200 meters down the tarmac fence, she drew to a stop, adjusted her sling, smoothed back her sweat-slicked hair, the blonde locks longer and sloppier than she was used to, irritating her nape, and listened to a howl mixed with a high-pitched whine far above. She craned her neck, squinting into the gray light, and looked to the blotch in the sky. Right on time. In all the chaos of a civil war, in one obscure corner of the galaxy, the rebels somehow kept their daily transport on schedule. Maybe the New Republic had a chance after all. The GR-75 was an aging beast of a starship, slow to maneuver and bulky even for its class. But Quell felt a pang as the tapered vessel descended, washing her with exhaust and radiant heat. Somewhere aboard, a pilot calculated landing vectors and calibrated instruments for atmospheric pressure. A pilot who, if only when flying without passengers or cargo, surely accelerated past her ship's recommended limits and tested herself against the resulting G-forces. Quell's fingers played along an invisible set of controls. Then she clenched her fists shut. "Give me a shuttle," she thought. "An airspeeder, even a flight simulator." The GR-75 tapped the tarmac hard enough to jolt the ground. Quell watched through the fence as one of the outpost sentries performed a cursory inspection of the ship's hull, before signaling for the boarding ramp to lower. A tentacled New Republic officer was the first passenger to disembark. The officer passed a datapad to the sentry, and the march of new arrivals began. After the officer, they were nearly all human. That was the most obvious clue to their origins. The Empire had been, as the propaganda said, built on the labor of galactic humanity. The passengers were mostly young, but not without exception. Mostly clean-cut, though a few were untidy. They looked across the tarmac with trepidation. To a person, they had attempted to rid themselves of identifying gear. Even the ones still in Imperial uniforms had stripped away all symbols and regalia. Quell suspected some carried their insignia badges anyway, secreted in pockets or sleeves. She'd encountered more than one set of rank plaques at the junk swap. She identified the ex-stormtroopers by their boots, too sturdy and well-fitted to abandon, their white synth leather caked in grime and turned the yellow of a bad tooth. Quell gave the stormtroopers a perfunctory glance and removed them from her mental checklist. The officers were given away by their bearing, and she scanned their features, searching her memory for matches and finding none. "I have an extremely good memory," she told the droid. And it was true. She felt a vague satisfaction at identifying a combat medic by her academy ring, but otherwise noticed nothing remarkable. All of them were bastards, she knew. The new arrivals got worse every day. When Quell had arrived a month ago, Traitor's Remorse had already been crowded with the first wave of deserters who'd abandoned their posts after the Battle of Endor. Some had come out of bravery, others out of cowardice. But Quell respected their foresight. They'd understood that the Emperor who'd built an interstellar civilization and governed for 2 decades was dead, and that his empire wouldn't endure without him. That without an heir, the Empire's sins, and they were many, the most zealous loyalty officer couldn't believe otherwise, would corrupt and destroy what remained. That the impossible victory that the Rebel Alliance had achieved, the assassination of the Emperor aboard his own massive battle station, was worth embracing wholeheartedly. Quell hadn't been part of that first wave. Instead, she'd come during the second. The days after the Emperor's death had been chaotic. The massive uprisings on thousands of planets, along with proving that the rebels had been right all along about public sentiment toward the Empire, made it clear that there would be no return to the old ways, no swift restoration of familiar rule. Yet a strategy of sorts soon emerged inside the remains of the Imperial military. Fleets across known space took part in Operation Cinder, the leveling of civilizations on Necronus and Vardos, Candovant and Kaminor, and more besides. Planets both loyal and in open revolt, planets rich in resources and planets that possessed nothing but faded glory. They were bombed and gassed and flooded, their own weather patterns and geology turned against them. Necronus was ravaged by siltstorms. Tectonic devices shattered the crust of Sensoritis. The Empire tried to destroy them all, not to deny the New Republic access to vital territories, not to thwart insurrections, not as part of any meaningful plan to secure the Empire. The surviving admirals had said it was for all those reasons, yet not one was fully satisfactory. Maybe Operation Cinder had been conducted out of some sort of perceived necessity, but it was fueled by rage, and it would do nothing, it was obvious, beyond obvious, to slow the Empire's disintegration. Cinder had been a turning point. Loyal soldiers who had executed whole planets at the Emperor's behest had seen billions of lives snuffed out for no strategic gain, and known that the moral calculus had changed. Imperial heroes, unable to stomach the slaughter, had turned on their superiors. Naboo, the Emperor's own homeworld, had been saved from genocide with the aid of Imperial Special Forces commandos. They had come to a shared realization. It was one thing to fight a losing battle, and another to disregard the cost. That had been the second wave of desertions and defections, which meant anyone who'd stayed afterward had made a conscious choice to forget the cost, to forget the fact that preserving the Empire as it had been was a lost cause, to fight on anyway, consequences be damned. Every day after Operation Cinder, the pointlessness of the carnage became clearer. Every day, those remaining inside the Empire were tested anew. So far as Quell was concerned, the men and women aboard the GR-75 transport had failed too many tests to deserve sympathy or redemption. The ones who came tomorrow would be worse still. A voice penetrated her thoughts like a needle into skin.
See anyone you like?
A man in a rumpled coat picked his way toward Quell, looking between her and the grass, as if afraid he might step on a mine or a glass shard. He would have appeared human, wiry black hair flecked with gray, brown skin, shades darker than Quell's own tawny hue, a skinny physique lost under his garments, if it hadn't been for the two wormy stalks protruding from his skull. She identified the species. Balazar.
Not really, she said. She hadn't seen him before, hadn't noticed him arrive on a transport, nor stood in line with him for rations. He wasn't in uniform, but he surely wasn't a defector. She added, no rule about standing on this side of the fence.
Stand where you want, the man replied.
He stopped 3 paces away and squinted in the direction of the transport. The new arrivals continued their march, each exchanging a few words with the sentry before heading for processing.
Who are you watching for? You come here every day. Are you expecting friends? A lover? Rescue? We're free to go, aren't we? Why would I need rescue?
It was a half-truth, and Quell was curious how the man would react. Officially, the residents of Traitor's Remorse could leave at any time, but taking flight would guarantee the New Republic's ire, and who knew what sort of grudge the rebel government would hold. Anyone not in line for a pardon was risking a perilous future. The man simply shrugged.
I'm glad to hear you say that. Not everyone feels the same way.
His voice flattened.
Answer the question, please. Who are you watching for?
Quell heard the entitlement. The man had authority, or wanted her to think he did. She didn't look at him, and found her answer in the march of defectors.
You see the one with the scars?
She lifted one finger, barely a gesture, in the direction of a bulky man in a leather vest. Rough red marks ran from his neck to the undersides of his ears.
I do,
the Balasar said, though his attention was entirely on Quell. I've seen scars like that. Surgical augmentations. My guess is he was a candidate for one of the elite stormtrooper divisions. Death troopers, maybe. But his body couldn't take the mods.
Supposing that's true, it's very likely in his file. Why are you watching him?
Quell whirled to face the man. She kept her voice level, excised the frustration. If he was with the New Republic, she needed him. You've got a man with that past, who stayed with the Empire as long as he did. You think he's good recruiting material? You want him wandering around the outpost free and clear? The Balasar's lips twitched, and he smiled in realization.
You're looking out for us. That's generous, but we won the war. We can manage our own security.
He extended a hand.
Cairn Aiden. Alliance, excuse me, New Republic Intelligence.
Quell took the hand. In all her interviews since arriving, she'd never met a New Republic spy. If he'd been Imperial Intelligence, she might have been terrified. But terror seemed premature. The man's grip was weak until she squeezed. Then it became a pinch. Erica Quell, she said. Former Lieutenant, 204th Fighter Wing. At your mercy.
The 204th was never known for its mercy, though, was it?
He looked like he was about to laugh, but he never did.
Shadow Wing, your people called it. Quite a name, up there with Death Star. Sightings all over prior to Endor, at Black Tar Sist and Menar Day, slaughtering rebels and keeping the hyperlane safe. Did you happen to fly at Mimban?
The litany of names struck like blows. She didn't flinch. He had come prepared, and he had come for her. Before my time, she said.
Too bad. It's a story I'd love to hear. Some of my colleagues didn't notice you all until, well, until Necronus. But we both know you were spectacular for years. If Grand General Loring had appreciated you more, if Vader had paid more attention to the Starfighter Corps, you'd probably have been at Endor yourselves. Maybe kept the poor Emperor alive.
Maybe so. Aiden waited for more. His smile wilted, but didn't disappear. Finally, he went on.
That's all past. Since Operation Cinder, though, Shadow Wing keeps popping up. 9 sightings in just over 2 weeks, tearing apart convoys, bombing outposts. Even took out one of our star cruisers.
Another blow, aimed with more care than before. He might have been lying about Shadow Wing, but it sounded possible, even plausible. Again, she didn't flinch, though she felt her injuries throb in time with her pulse. 9 sightings in 2 weeks, Quell said. It's been a month since Necronus. Aiden nodded brusquely, scanned the ground as if searching for a place to sit, then shifted his weight from foot to foot.
Which is why I'm here. Dozens of the Empire's finest pilots disappear at a time like this. They're not hiding out awaiting orders. They're running silent.
She didn't look at the trail of defectors still emerging onto the tarmac. She didn't even meet Aiden's gaze. She was focused on the words, turning them over in her head.
You have a theory, she asked. I have a plan, Aiden said. I'm assembling a working group to study the situation. Experts who can analyze the data and predict the enemy's next move. Maybe do some investigative legwork.
She fixed the words in her mind. I'm assembling a working group. She cut the resistance from her voice like a tumor. Cautiously, she answered,
I was hoping for a military position, somewhere I could fly.
Aiden's smile was rejuvenated.
I'm sure you were, but we've seen your file. The Shadow Wing pilot who couldn't save Necronus. No high-level clearance, no access to classified intelligence or special expertise. Just a solid track record of shooting rebels. You're not anyone's favorite candidate for recruitment.
So work for New Republic Intelligence, Quell heard, though he didn't say the words. Sit at a console and help us hunt your friends. Maybe you'll even get a pardon out of it. What Aiden uttered aloud was,
Consider it. If I decide I want you, I'll find you. And I expect you to have an answer ready.
For a month, Erica Quell had waited to prove herself, to show that she had abandoned the 204th Fighter Wing for a reason, to show that she could offer the New Republic a talent it lacked, bringing Imperial rigor and discipline to its starfighter corps. She had waited to take part in the war's end, to fly again. She had waited to do something decent for once, the way she'd wanted to long ago. She wasn't certain Cairn Aiden was offering any of what she wanted. Maybe she hadn't earned it. Traitor's remorse turned cold at night. The gently numbing chill of the day turned to wind that whipped Quell's poncho around her hips and forced her to keep her good hand on the brim of her hood. She pushed against the gale as she trudged between stacked containers turned houses, under swinging electrical cables, and into the shelter of a bunker dug out of a low hillside. The wind's roar faded within, replaced by laughter and conversation. As her eyes adjusted to the dim light, Quell saw 24 figures seated on crates and on the dirt floor. They were playing cards and dice, swapping old tales and showing old scars. They should have been drinking, but there was nothing worth drinking in Traitor's Remorse. There was harder contraband for those with a taste for Rill or Death Sticks, but no one was fool enough to indulge where the New Republic watched. Quell had come to the Warren to trade. She had no friends in Traitor's Remorse, passing acquaintances, an old man with whom she shared her supper rations, but no friends. Yet seniority had its privileges. She'd been at the outpost as long as anyone, and she knew which New Republic officers were forgiving, and which held special grudges. She knew where to buy an extra meal, and who claimed to be able to smuggle out messages. She could swap rumors for rumors. And the people who might know about Cairn Aiden would give her a measure of attention. She passed deeper into the bunker, down a hallway and past a young logistics consultant, brokering the exchange of military casualty lists. She nodded to an engineer who'd helped her repair a faulty heater, but the man was fixated on a diagram he'd sketched on the floor. She saw none of the regulars she sought, and she was nearly ready to move on when she spotted the stormtrooper. The surgical augmentation scars on his neck seemed to burn in the flickering electric light. He turned a hydro spanner over in his hands as if it were a weapon. If he was the sort to join the death troopers, maybe he'd used one as a bludgeon before. Quell wasn't a fighter by nature. She'd never gotten into a pointless scrap in her academy days, and only once been in a fistfight as a teenager. She was military, true, but she was a pilot first. Shooting things was the least of her duties. Nonetheless, she approached the man unafraid of what might come next. "Why'd you finally jump ship?" she planned to say. And if he gave the wrong answer? If he took a swing at her? After a day of feeling small and frustrated and helpless, maybe a fight was what she needed. She never got to say a word. She felt the rumble first. The ground bucked, and she swallowed a lungful of dust before the thunder even registered. The screaming that followed was strangely muffled, and she realized she'd gone deaf. She was blind, too, but that was the dust again, pale white clouds that stung her nostrils and scattered the dim illumination. "I'm hit," she thought, and knew it to be a lie. She was fine. She wasn't sure about the rest of the Warren. One part of her brain calmly reconstructed what had happened as she stumbled forward. There had been a bomb. Nothing big, maybe a jury-rigged plasma grenade. Someone had planted it in another room, or carried it inside and triggered the detonator. Someone like one of the new defectors who'd arrived on the GR-75, determined to make an example of those who betrayed the Empire. She pieced the story together easily, because it had happened twice before. This was the closest she'd been to a blast. Her foot crushed something soft, an arm covered in blood and scraps of leather. Leaning forward, she was desperately relieved to see it was attached to a body. The stormtrooper. The death trooper candidate. She knelt beside him and wrapped her good arm around his burly chest, allowing him to scale her and stand. He was a bastard, she reminded herself as they lurched toward the exit. But then, so was everyone at Traitor's Remorse.
They struggled forward step by step, coughing up grime and navigating by the muted shouting. Eventually, Quell felt the weight of the stormtrooper disappear and realized another person had lifted him away. She could almost hear again. Someone, perhaps the same person who had taken the stormtrooper, asked about her health. She choked out a reply and stepped out of the warren and into the artificial glow of the shantytown. No one prevented her from pushing forward through the perimeter of the ex-Imperial onlookers and tense New Republic security officers. No one cared enough to try. She briefly considered going back, but she was dizzy and half-deaf and could see the dust on her breath. She'd just get in the way of the rescue team. But she realized as she coughed and spat that she had the answer she'd come for. She wasn't sure Cairn Aiden would give her an opportunity to fly or to prove herself or to do anything decent. But the bombing had reminded her that those things were luxuries. She had to find a way out of Traitor's Remorse. Any chance was worth taking. 3. Cairn Aiden stretched an elastic band between thumb and forefinger, let loose, and watched the band soar across the supply closet that served as his office. It deformed in flight, missing ITO by 10 centimeters and puncturing the cone of azure particles emitted by the droid's holoprojector. The humanoid figure standing within the cone pixelated and flickered into non-existence.
"You're aggravated,"
the droid said unhelpfully.
"I'm attempting to get something actionable out of you," Cairn answered.
"Actionable intelligence is your area, not mine."
ITO adjusted its holoprojector, a gift Cairn had installed in the droid many months earlier, and the figure reformed, magnified a dozen times over. Erica Quell stared lifelessly over her jutting nose out of creaseless, bloodshot eyes. There was a fragility to her that went beyond the obvious cuts on her lips and scalp, a sort of glass-like sharpness equally likely to injure or shatter. Imperial arrogance ground down and humbled. Cairn studied the image and sighed.
"Suppose you're right," he said. "She's lying. What exactly is she lying about? Or..."
He silenced the droid with a slash of his hand.
"Give me this. What do we think is true?"
ITO floated like a toy boat in a slow current.
"She has suffered trauma,"
it said. Cairn resisted the urge to interject, "Haven't we all?"
"Physically, of course,"
the droid went on.
"But she's struggling to process recent events. She's isolated, simultaneously hypervigilant and unfocused."
"Vague," Cairn said. "Ever consider telling fortunes for a living?"
"Building a rapport requires time. Without a rapport, I can be of little use to my patient or to you."
It was an old argument, and Cairn was eager to move past it.
"Her background checks out, so far as we can tell. We can't confirm operational details, but she was definitely part of Shadow Wing."
He rose and moved his hand to the door's control panel.
"Any reason to think she's a spy? Could the whole defector story be a ruse?"
"If she's a spy, she's not an especially good one, given how suspicious we are of her already."
"Maybe the Empire is fresh out of competent spies."
Cairn tapped the panel and stepped into the hallway.
"Come on, we need air."
They moved through the corridors of the bunker, past makeshift processing stations and communications rigs. One of the military interviewers mumbled a greeting at Cairn, and Cairn muttered back. ITO received glowers from several officers and was ignored by others. The torture droid was divisive at the best of times. Once outside, Cairn pulled his coat around him. He felt a distant buzz, some sort of cutting rig slicing through rock, and retracted his antenna palps into his skull to reduce the bothersome sensation. The source appeared to be a fenced-off section of the outpost over the next hill. He waved ITO along, tromping through grass and dirt until he saw the ruins of the bombed bunker. A dozen New Republic workers clustered about the entrance, dragging equipment and stone and bodies into the mid-morning light.
"You know what this is?"
he asked ITO, nodding in the direction of the rubble.
"Something symbolic of whatever argument you intend to make."
Cairn scoffed. He brought his sleeve to his upper lip as his nose dripped from the cold. It's an intelligence failure. Yes, it's symbolic. It was also predictable and preventable. It's the fourth bombing we've had here.
We are in agreement,
ITO said.
It was indeed preventable.
But no one else sees it. We've got an outpost full of ground pounders and flyboys who think security means shoot down anyone who finds the secret base. But the bases aren't secret anymore, and we've got too many problems to shoot.
In truth, it was worse than that. The problem was leadership. The New Republic was a military organization. No matter what Chancellor Mothma said, its roots in the insurgent Rebel Alliance ran deep. And it only understood military solutions. He didn't need to reiterate that point to ITO, and instead said,
"Intelligence will hold the New Republic together, or the New Republic won't hold at all. No one up top seems to realize that. No one seems to care, no matter how many bombs are planted."
There are those in government who care about the dead. You know this.
About the dead? Maybe. But not about what's killing them.
We're talking about a government that's barely had time to form,
ITO said.
To attribute any philosophy of national security to the New Republic is, at this stage, premature.
Maybe,
Cairn repeated. He glanced at the droid, wondering, as he often did, whether ITO was manipulating him, nudging him toward a conclusion he might not otherwise reach. But the droid's crimson photoreceptor gave no hints.
Regardless, New Republic intelligence is underfunded and understaffed. But if someone did something right for a change...
You believe that an intelligence operation to dismantle the 204th Fighter Wing would force New Republic leadership to re-examine its priorities?
Shouldn't it?
Cairn turned his back on the rubble and dust.
Shadow Wing was trouble before the Battle of Endor, but back then we were more scared of another Death Star battle station than Imperial fighter pilots. Now they're making precision strikes. We lost all hands aboard the Huntsman and the Kalpana. I'm sure the 204th was involved in the raid on Bochin. Exclude the Operation Cinder genocides, and they're still responsible for the deaths of thousands.
He swept his arms to indicate the broken bunker.
This is what the Empire looks like now. Fewer planet-killing superweapons, more murderous fanatics.
Counter-terrorism being an intelligence specialty.
Exactly.
Cairn clapped his hands together.
If an intelligence working group were to neutralize Shadow Wing, it would prove everything I've been saying. The threat and the solution.
And once New Republic leadership agrees that Imperial splinter groups are best countered by intelligence officers, do you imagine that would justify a massive resource allotment to the working group that neutralized Shadow Wing? Along with said working group supervisor.
Cairn shrugged.
Why not? It's better for everyone.
The droid's repulsors whined as its spherical body navigated past Cairn, descending a meter down the hillside in the direction of the rubble.
Is this about defeating an enemy of the New Republic, or about seizing power in a time of political instability?
Why not both?
Cairn failed to hide his irritation. He wanted to repeat himself. It's better for everyone. And it was. Shadow Wing's threat was real and ongoing, and if neutralizing it led to greater intelligence resources and his own personal elevation, that would lead to fewer bombings and fewer Operation Cinders. Running a government and defending a populace weren't the same as assassinating an emperor. The sooner the New Republic realized that, the better.
He forced himself to draw a breath and regroup.
The real question, he said, is this. Is Irika Quell the person I need?
The droid didn't move. Cairn recognized ITO's deep concentration as it ran dozens of scenarios and dredged through 1,000 years of medical texts for an answer. The silence calmed Cairn. However much of an annoyance ITO could be, Cairn found the droid's willingness to work, to sort facts and make the best possible call, no matter how ferociously they'd argued. Comforting.
No,
ITO said.
I don't believe she is.
He visibly flinched as frustration reignited in his chest. He turned his eyes to the column of smoke, rising intermittently from the rubble.
She had been there, he knew. Quell had been spotted pulling someone from the wreckage. And he tried to picture her wounded, brittle form, caked in dust and blood. She was a liar. A woman who'd committed who knew what crimes during her time with the 204th. A woman who'd seen the Empire crumble and now claimed to have a conscience. Cairn had seen her kind before. He never forgave them. And sooner or later, they all reverted to type. But he could handle that. He needed her. Whatever ITO claimed.
Call our friend, Cairn said. The working group convenes tomorrow.
Chapter 2. Angle of Attack. 1. They weren't heroes, but they celebrated like they were. They marched across skyways arm in arm and launched fireworks under the grinning moon of Jeruse. They sang imperial anthems, inserting vulgar jokes in place of homages. They danced to music drifting out from club doors and apartment windows. Danced to their own clapping in plazas and parks and under the disapproving glowers of defaced statues. And as they celebrated like heroes, so too were they celebrated. The people of Jeruse emerged to ask their names, to offer food and drink, to welcome them into the festivities that had lasted a month and seemed primed to continue into eternity. They danced with the people of Jeruse until they were dizzy and their flight suits were soaked with sweat, stopping only to drink from canteens and fountains before returning to dancing. They were comrades, veterans of a war they'd won not long ago. In the hour after midnight, they walked through a garden of scintillating colors and said goodbye to one of their own.
Will Lark, you fleshy peasant boy, you will be missed, whatever the others say.
Sassanik croaked and clacked, his beak working under engorged eye stalks, as if he were swallowing a small animal. He leaned heavily against Will, ready to topple without support. A gesture Will had learned indicated fondness among Sassanik's people, and not inebriation, as a passerby might have reasonably assumed.
You've always been kind to me, Will replied. I'll miss...
He was interrupted by another round of clacking and croaking.
Sanagari! He will never admit to missing you so long as Sassanik is here to tend his wounded heart. Nazi will spit on every sheet you ever slept on. Rep boy, never. Why, in all of Riot Squadron, only Sassanik shall truly miss you.
Sassanik went on and Will grinned and turned to Sanagari, who kissed Will firmly on the forehead before splashing through a pond of glowing lilies. And to Nazi, who rolled her eyes. Renunja, a lean-faced Duros, whose steel-blue skin seemed mossy in the garden, spoke over Sassanik with a voice that exuded authority.
You're certain then? Tomorrow?
Unless you need me, Will said. Otherwise I'll follow the course we talked about, keep my scanner on, and turn over my ship when I arrive.
We'll always need pilots. We won't need you.
Renunja gently prized Sassanik's claws off Will's shoulder as she spoke.
The Hellion's Dare has orders to hold position over Jeruse until the last of the scout reports are in. After that, Riot may return to a combat zone, but the war won't be what it was.
Will nodded. The week since Endor had been as calm as he could remember. There had been fighting, of course, furious battles against scattered Imperial forces. But the primary mission of the Hellion's Dare and its starfighter squadrons had been reconnaissance. The fall of the Empire had led to communications breakdowns across the galaxy, and the New Republic needed to identify which systems had lost a hyperwave relay and which had been overrun and blockaded by Imperial holdouts. So far, Will had seen more than a few of the former, and none of the latter. Sometimes they had found worlds like Jeruse. Will didn't know why the locals loathed the Empire so, or why they found such unutterable joy in its downfall. He didn't know how old its plazas and gardens and skyways were,
or what crimes the Imperial garrison and its commander had committed. Most of the Jerusi barely spoke Galactic Basic, so Will was simply grateful to be a visitor on Jerus in a time of beauty. He was also ready to go home. Renunja strolled on ahead. Will and Satanique and Nazi and a dozen others took the scenic route through the garden, under fronds whose radiance blazed and dimmed with the sounds of their voices. They trekked on past entangled Jerusi lovers and into a marketplace strung with gaudy lanterns and smelling of Corellian cinnamon. They ate sweets and began telling stories of their own time together. Some stories were of battles, at Maegito, where Riot Squadron had earned its name, at Thumbsnapper's Bridge, where pirates had nearly achieved a victory even the Empire hadn't aspired to. But more were of pranks and foolish errors, and the dreams of dead comrades. Talk eventually turned to Will and his tenure with the squadron, and he was surprised to hear a voice call, "You're a damn coward!" The heckler was perched on the second tier of a multi-level fountain that loomed over the market. She was compact and muscular, bronze-skinned with a fuzz of lime-green hair and short, fleshy horns protruding from her temples. Marks of a Thelin, though Will didn't know if she identified with that species or another. Thelin ancestry was a sensitive topic. He frowned at her taunt, more puzzled than insulted. As Nazi shouted back at her, Satanique shook Will's shoulder with one claw and croaked, "Don't worry. Chas is always itchy without combat duty." Will nodded. He'd been among enough rebels to understand.
"She's Hound Squadron?"
"It would explain it, no?" Satanique said.
One by one, the pilots of Riot Squadron drifted away, to their starfighters or hostiles or the Hellions' Dare, depending on their duties and interests. The Hound Squadron pilots and the Dare's crew took separate paths. Will and Satanique were left alone, walking along a skyway through the residential district.
"You're safe for tonight?" Satanique asked. "I could escort you to the Dare."
"Message Jerusi," Will said. "Gave me a key and told me to stay with her any time."
Satanique erupted in a fit of croaking laughter before throwing both arms skyward.
"Will Lark, the beloved! Gift to the galaxy!"
Someone at ground level echoed the shout, and Satanique cackled once again. In a more subdued tone, he added,
"The best pilot I ever knew."
"We saved the galaxy together," Will said.
"We had the best times," Satanique answered.
Will slept on a mountain of cushions softer than any bed he'd ever encountered, too tired even to wake his host. His final thoughts before dreaming were of his comrades, his brothers and sisters, in the unit, and how soothing his last days in Riot Squadron had been. He woke to sirens. The noise reverberated through the city, unfamiliar in its precise pitch and cadence, but unmistakable in meaning. He scrambled to dress and pulled curtains aside, scanning the sky through the apartment's glass wall. In the pre-dawn light, dark flecks streamed across the clouds in thin bands, like nocturnal insects going to feed. Will imagined he could hear the screams of ion engines, though the sirens overwhelmed everything.
"TIE fighters," he thought. "The Empire is here."
He was zipping his flight suit closed as he sprinted down the skyway toward the platform where he'd landed his starfighter. He could see flashes of light high above. The dark flecks spiraled around a single bright point, the Hellions' Dare. He spotted his RZ-1 interceptor and felt unexpected relief. He'd feared, without thinking, that he would find his A-wing reduced to slag by an enemy scout. Yet the craft was intact, and he half-climbed, half-leapt into the sleek, triangular body, wedging the toes of his boots between metal seams as he scrambled toward the cockpit. Every scorch mark on the hull, every dent and chip in the amber paint, was familiar. He forced himself to contemplate none of them as the canopy slid open and he dropped into the pilot's seat.
"We're going to help our friends," he murmured as he flipped switches and tapped buttons.
He ignited the fusion reactor, activated the displays, distributed power to all components.
The ritual was as familiar as the ship's scars. His voice was placating, and the low hum of the engine seemed to answer.
We're going up, okay? One more mission.
There were a dozen pre-flight diagnostics he should have run, manual equipment checks he should have performed, especially without a ground crew at hand. A-wings were temperamental, prone to thruster decalibrations and componentized power losses and shorting out whatever gear seemed most vital. They were jury-rigged machines, stripped and modified by the Rebel Alliance for speed over heavy firepower or durability. And the consequences were apparent in every minute of flight. Will hoped his lack of caution wouldn't prove fatal. The A-Wing lifted smoothly off the platform, repulsors whinnying and familiar vibrations running through Will's seat as he retracted the landing gear. He couldn't help smiling.
You get to let loose.
Then they were airborne, thrusters roaring, racing over skyways and between buildings as the starfighter gained altitude and pitched at the open sky. Gravity and acceleration pushed Will against his seat, and he struggled to focus his sight on the black spiral above. Seconds later, he entered the fray. Riot Squadron had already engaged. Pairs of A-Wing fighters swung into the TIE's spiral path to scatter enemy flights before they could make their attack runs at the Hellion's Dare. The New Republic frigate floated above the thin haze of Jerusa's atmosphere, shields shimmering as it absorbed volleys of particle bolts, turbo lasers discouraging enemy approaches from a dozen angles. Orbiting the Dare were the cross-shaped slivers of Hound Squadron's B-Wings, sticking close to the mothership and unleashing massive firepower at any TIE that reached optimal weapons range. Will activated his comm and announced,
Riot 3, coming in!
Renunja, Riot Leader, was the first to answer.
Counting 30 eyeballs in tight formation, Riot 3. They're ignoring us, except when we disrupt their attack pattern. They want the Dare. They don't much care about fighter kills. Bombers?
Will asked.
Negative.
Nazi's voice, crisp and low. Riot 8.
Not that we've spotted.
Satanik corrected. Riot 5.
Plenty of opportunity for error.
The chatter continued, identifying TIE vectors and the Dare's targets. Will listened, but concentrated elsewhere. The scanner was barely intelligible. 30 TIEs and 2 New Republic squadrons meant upward of 50 marks, most of them fast enough to cross the engagement zone in moments, which left him reliant on eyes and instincts as much as sensors. If he died, he'd likely never see the shot that atomized his ship. He joined Riot 4 and Riot 8 as they set course for the spiral. In practiced shorthand, Nazi described her plan to approach perpendicular to the TIEs, curving into their spiral flight path with a tight turn and punching through the enemy arc. If the Riot pilots were lucky and their aim was true, they'd destroy one or two of the fighters in the process. If they were unlucky, whether or not they hit their targets, additional TIEs would pursue them as they escaped, well positioned to pick off the 3 A-Wings. Shaking the foe would be difficult, but even drawing pursuit would leave the spiral formation fragmented. They accelerated together and matched velocities. In a planetary atmosphere, their speed would have been incomprehensible. In the vastness of open space, speed and distance were relative, fathomable only in how one related to the other. Will's A-Wing was traveling fast, therefore the enemy was near. The black void yawned above his cockpit, denying him any sense of orientation as he banked into the turn. His targeting computer flashed as they neared the stream of TIEs. He responded by squeezing the trigger of his control yoke, and he heard the energized warble of his cannons. Red lightning rippled around him as Riot 4 and 8, too, made their attacks. The TIEs danced like dead leaves tossed by a breeze, and the volley of particle bolts passed harmlessly through the gaps between enemy ships. The stray energy would dissipate into the dark. The 3 A-Wings increased their thrust and pulled out of the path of the spiral. No one pursued. Riot 8 swore.
They saw us coming. They've trained at this, and we picked the most obvious way to break them. The spiral attack pattern is new,
Riot 4 said.
Who wants to get creative?
We can take another pass,
Will said.
They're giving us room. We might as well...
No.
Riot Leader again, steady as always.
Hellion's Dare is about to lose a deflector. Bolster our perimeter around the frigate and prepare to jump to light speed. Go coordinates incoming on your Navi computers.
Riot 8 swore again. Will craned his neck and tried to spot the jutting body of the frigate before adjusting course. At his current speed, he'd need to arc wide to return to the Hellion's Dare. Trying to turn any sharper would tear his inertial compensators apart. So as he steered through the turn and felt the A-wing rattle, he listened to the comm chatter and watched the battle on his scanner. He heard Satanique laugh bleakly as a TIE flew close enough to disrupt his sensors with its ion trails. He watched another TIE shake a concussion missile after a tense 15-second chase. He watched the Hellion's Dare creep out of Jerusa's orbit, determined to escape the planet's gravity well. His Navi computer signaled the receipt of hyperspace coordinates, as the Hellion's Dare absorbed a barrage powerful enough to send its shields shimmering through the color spectrum. Multiple voices cried out reports as the TIE swarm converged on the frigate and trapped A-wings and B-wings against the capital ship's hull. Then the final order came.
Now! Jump now!
Will let the computer calculate his trajectory and felt his fighter lurch forward. The stars warped as the laws of conventional physics, of light and velocity and mass, ceased to exist, and the ship's hyperdrive urged the vessel through a gap in reality. The jump felt profound to Will, no matter how many times he'd done it. It was a glimpse into something otherworldly, something transcendent. The cerulean storm of hyperspace enfolded the A-wing, and he left the battle behind. There was no sound but the hum of the hyperdrive. Even the ship's rattling ceased. There was only the journey through a universe far from Jerus, and the ruins of the Empire. When Will Lark's A-Wing returned to real space through a second gap in reality, the pilot's first act was to lean onto his console and gaze out at the stars. The sky was clear, but the constellations were foreign. Thousands of unfamiliar suns glimmered against the darkness, joined instants later by new lights that blazed into existence one by one, the distant specks of starfighters. The A-Wings of Riot Squadron came first, followed by the B-wings of Hound Squadron. Finally, the great mass of the Hellion's Dare, the Nebulon B frigate, slid silently into place above Will. The comm chatter began immediately.
Riot leader standing by.
Riot 2 standing by.
3.
4.
5.
6.
7.
Riot 8 was silent.
I don't think Nazi made it, Satanique said. I saw a TIE flight move on her position at the end, right before we jumped.
No one spoke for a while.
She fought bravely,
Renunja finally said.
You all did.
But there was no comfort in the words. It wasn't until later, after the Dare had recalled the starfighters to its hangar, and Will had stripped off his flight suit. After he had embraced Sonogari, who refused to weep for Nazi, and who would mourn her the most, that he realized, with a pang of distress and selfish guilt, the least important consequence of the battle. Will wasn't going home yet, after all. 2. Quell hadn't known what to expect from Cairn Aiden's New Republic Intelligence Working Group, but she'd pictured something involving conference rooms and computer terminals and droids, something sleek and dull and formidably bureaucratic, like the Empire might have assembled. Instead, following a brusque discussion with Aiden regarding the terms of her parole and the distant possibility of a Senate pardon, contingent on Aiden's recommendation and the elimination of the shadowing threat, she'd been instructed to board a UT-60D transport that afternoon for a recruiting mission. It wasn't until after the U-Wing left atmosphere that she realized she'd never see Traitor's Remorse again. She could accept that. There was no one at the outpost she wanted to say goodbye to. She'd left nothing behind but a duffel full of donated clothes. Now she owned only what she carried, and she found that thought freeing, at least until she remembered the locker of mementos and honors and personal effects stowed in the bowels of the Star Destroyer Pursuer. Her old life existed, whether or not it was in sight. Whether she had any idea where it lurked in the vastness of space, waiting to collide with her in the dark. For now, she chose not to think about it. She sat in the cabin of the vessel, the glow of hyperspace illuminating the cockpit doorway, while the rhythmic pulse of the drive system counted down. She distracted herself by perusing the datapad containing the particulars of her recruiting mission. She found nothing comforting in the files.
"You have questions,"
said the voice of the torture droid. The black sphere floated in the corner of the cabin, photoreceptor oriented toward Quell, as if the machine was planning her dissection. "It's straightforward," Quell said, and gestured at the datapad. "You think this man will be useful? I'll get him for you." The man was a roach, but Quell was too sensible to say so. She was an agent of the New Republic now, and she'd been military long enough not to share unsolicited opinions.
"Not about the man,"
the droid said.
"About the circumstances. You must have wondered why I'm here."
She had briefly wondered why her therapist was accompanying her. Then she'd figured it out. "You're monitoring me for Aiden and New Republic intelligence, to see if I'm fit for duty, to see if I'm loyal. As I said, straightforward. I was never just your patient, and I can't say I'm surprised."
"As a medical unit, I confess my loyalties are divided between the patients I treat and the masters I..."
A surge of fury rose in Quell, and she nearly threw the datapad at the droid. Then she extinguished her ire as if snuffing a match between calloused fingers. "I don't really care about the psychiatric ethics of droids, and I don't think anyone would mistake you for a medical unit." The droid rotated one of its manipulators, a gesture of apology or perhaps discomfort. Quell wasn't sure. She searched her memories of their past sessions, trying to determine whether she'd said anything regrettable. But she'd been careful. She'd said nothing that would incriminate or embarrass her. And if Cairn Aiden went looking through recordings, looking for leverage against her, he would search in vain. Not that it made a difference.
"I hope that this will not impede future sessions," the droid said. "I would very much like to assist your rehabilitation."
"I'd like that too," Quell lied, and resumed studying the datapad. Cairn Aiden would search the droid's recordings in vain, and she would still commit to the mission. She would still follow orders, because she hadn't yet earned the New Republic's trust, and she knew what it meant to prove herself. She doubted the man she'd been sent to recruit knew anything of the sort. According to his file, Nath Tenzint had defected from the Empire, along with his entire TIE squadron, more than 4 years ago, shortly before the DS-1 battle station had destroyed Alderaan and spurred discontent throughout the galaxy. Unlike most rebels from that era, his motives had been less than idealistic. He and his squadron had been under investigation for gross corruption, and he'd needed safe harbor. Tenzint and his people had been running a criminal enterprise across 8 systems in the Outer Rim, giving pirates and smugglers a pass in return for a percentage of their take, while simultaneously demanding payment from merchant vessels and transports in return for protection from those same pirates. Corruption was common enough in the distant reaches of the Empire, where communications were patchy and loyalty officers were scarce. But Tenzint had eventually been discovered, and he decided to switch sides rather than face punishment. After that, his career with the Rebel Alliance had been curiously unremarkable. He'd flown with his same crew on over 50 missions with no reprimands and no decorations. Or at least that's what Quell's file indicated. On further consideration, she realized she had no reason to assume the record was complete. She was seeing what she was permitted to see. As with everything else, she'd earned nothing more. Tenzin's career in the Alliance had come to a halt 6 months before Endor, when his squadron had been obliterated by the 204th Imperial Fighter Wing. That encounter wasn't detailed in the file. The attached report only named a star system and listed the casualties. And it wasn't a skirmish Quell had any memory of. Tenzin's people had all died, and Tenzint himself had dropped out of communication while recuperating. It was, as Quell had said, straightforward. She wasn't sure what role Aiden wanted Tenzin to fill, but the man certainly had motivation to see Shadow Wing neutralized. Maybe that was all Aiden required for his working group. She did have one question, however. Why am I doing this? The droid hadn't moved from where it hovered near the bulkhead.
I beg your pardon?
I'm a pilot. Aiden's a spy. One of us is more qualified than the other for this sort of mission. The droid didn't answer for a long while, Quell counted the heartbeats of the hyperdrive before the artificial voice replied.
Cairn Aiden is not fond of fieldwork. You have all the necessary tools to succeed. Therefore, he deemed this the optimal use of available resources.
Quell took in the words. She wasn't sure what they meant. As with so many things, she decided it made no difference. Quell spent the remainder of the voyage in the cockpit, sitting beside a humanoid figure wrapped in strips of graying fabric, like bandages beneath a coarse cloak. Heavy leather straps and other swathes of cloth, perhaps once colorful and patterned but now murky, completed the patchwork ensemble, obscuring the tall figure's musculature. If it hadn't been for the helmet, a thing of riveted metal and clamps, lit by the flickering glow of its visor, the entity would have resembled the contents of an ancient sarcophagus more than an animate being. The ITO droid had called the being Kairos, and Quell couldn't begin to guess her species. The droid had only said,
"She is our pilot,"
and Quell had let the subject drop. In her way, however, the stranger was better company than the droid. Kairos said nothing. Her garment smelled inoffensively of iron and spices, and something floral. If she'd allowed Quell to touch the U-Wing's controls, Quell would have gladly kissed Kairos's horror of a mask. Yet when Quell had asked to fly, Kairos had dispassionately disabled the co-pilot station. The U-Wing lurched into real space within visual range of the Entropian Hive, an asteroid studded with silver space docks and swaddled in great organic meshes like webbing. Lights like sparks or dust motes drifted around the asteroid. Maintenance droids, perhaps, or shuttles transporting passengers between sealed sections. Quell didn't know. It felt familiar nonetheless. She'd seen dozens of black market trading posts and refueling stations over her career. Her fingers flexed on an imaginary control yoke as she recalled other outposts, other missions, the rush of escorting bombers past jury-rigged turbolasers, armed enemy freighters closing in. Her tide jumping as a shockwave assured her that the payload had been delivered and a pirate den had been eliminated. She recalled those battles without regret and wondered if that would ever change. Not every action the Empire had taken was corrupt. On balance, she might have killed more slavers than rebels. Maybe. Today, however, she was a passenger, and Kairos deployed no weapons. The strange being tapped gloved fingers against the ship's comm controls and transmitted an automated docking request. A reply came swiftly in a trilling, accented voice.
Honored visitors! On behalf of the Trading Council, I welcome you to the Entropian Hive.
Should I answer? Quell asked Kairos. Kairos said nothing. That's a no, Quell decided. The U-Wing lumbered toward the hive, decelerating as it entered a hangar built into the asteroid. The vessel touched ground, and its vibrations stopped as the engines powered down. Quell exited the cockpit and looked to see if Kairos would follow. The woman did not. The ITO droid floated in the same corner as always.
Are you coming with me? Quell asked.
Please keep me apprised of major developments,
the droid answered.
But I would not be especially welcome.
There was a convincing imitation of suppressed pain in the droid's voice. She imagined there weren't many places a torture droid would be welcome. Yet she couldn't muster sympathy. She tucked a comlink in her pocket and activated the starboard loading door. She'd found no weapons aboard the U-Wing and was keenly aware of her vulnerability. The pirates and slavers and smugglers of the Entropian Hive would see an unarmed woman, one arm tucked into a sling, and not be entirely wrong to deem her easy prey. Once her status with the Empire might have afforded her some protection. She had no shield now. She stepped outside the vessel and into the cavernous hangar. Freighters and shuttles rested atop rocky plinths, connected by metal catwalks, and a distant tunnel appeared to lead to the rest of the asteroid. There was an acridity to the air that made her nostrils burn, and she wondered whether the atmosphere was entirely human-breathable.
"May we assist you with your luggage?" a voice asked.
The speaker was a snouted humanoid with a body like a reed and skin the color of regurgitated bread. Beside it stood a protocol droid, arms stiffly extended.
No luggage, Quell said. She frowned at the speaker. It wasn't the greeting she'd been expecting.
Can we provide you with accommodations? A personal assistant tailored to your species and physiological preferences? Or perhaps...
The snout bobbed, and suction-tipped fingers wriggled in what, Quell surmised, was an indicator of thought.
Our medical facilities are state-of-the-art. I would need approval from the Entropian Hive Trading Council, but we could replace your failing limb. If not for free, perhaps at a steep discount.
Quell resisted the impulse to hug her arm closer to her chest. Not necessary, she said. Not desired. The human